Oh, it's very impressive. I'll talk about 2+1 dimensions as a setting for exploring a relation between quantum gravity and what's called doubly special relativity or deformed relativity. And the motivation for doing it in this setting is simply that in 2+1 you can talk about quantum gravity with some degree of mathematical precision. I'm interested in here is the relation with non-commutative geometry and the relation with deformed special relativity as a limit of quantum gravity, a remnant. And these are ideas that have been explored under the name of Kappa-Poincaré symmetry or deformed relativity in 3+1 dimensions. But there, of course, we don't have a quantum gravity to derive them. So my interest is to understand precisely the relation therefore, it's going to be it's quite broad, so I won't be able to go into much detail into all the things I want to discuss, but I want to give a broad picture of how the quantum gravity emerges in 2+1 and then relate it to what's called Kappa-Poincaré in 2+1, explain the relation between the two. And I hope that you won't be put off by occasional technical slides where I talk about Hopf algebras and I explain as far as possible what's involved. What I've tried as a guide for the talk to use physical constants. So in 3D gravity, you have potentially these four constants to play with. I'm going to set C to 1, so I'm not interested in taking a slow speed limit or anything like that. So C will remain 1, I won't play with that. But I am very much interested in how the other constants affect the structure of the theory. So the gravitational constant within 2+1 dimensions is an inverse mass. So that's a very important fact. That sets a mass scale without having an h-bar around. So you don't need h-bar to get a Planck mass. Classically, you have a mass scale. Then there's the cosmological constant, which gives you a curvature of the, or if you like, an inverse radius squared. And finally, there's h-bar. And you can combine this in two length parameters. One is the Planck length, so that involves h-bar. And the other one is the cosmological length scale, if you like, the curvature radius of a universe with that cosmological constant. And so these guys hopefully will at various points come back and put things in very simple physical terms, even if in between I've used technical language. So the structure of the talk is that I start off revisiting a very familiar example, just relativistic particle 2+1 dimensions. But I want to explain the relation between symmetry and phase space very carefully in that case, because that's is going to be the starting point for all the deformations that take place. Then I need to review how this thing gets deformed in 2+1 gravity and how one can quantize it. So those are topics 2 and 3. And once I've explained how the quantum groups arise, are related to the Kappa-Poincaré algebra. And much of what I say is based on work I did together with Kathleen over previous years. And then there's, at the end, some current work with Shyam Ajit that I'll talk about. I was once advised that a good talk should have 3 takeaway messages. And so I have inserted lessons in the talk, but I also read in the local tourist guide that this is one of the 5 most intelligent communities in the world. So I've actually included 5 lessons, okay? So there'll be 5 stops for 5 lessons at various points where I summarize where we got to and what we have learned at that point. Okay? The first lesson is some way off. It will take about half an hour, but then they come thick and fast. Okay? So that should set your internal clock. Okay, so I'll begin in a very simple setting, just reminding you where we are. So 2+1 is great because it looks like space, so you can actually visualize things. I'm using a metric that has mostly minus for space, and the Lorentz group in 2+1 dimensions is a 3-dimensional Lie group, SO2,1. And like the Lorentz group in higher dimensions, it can be viewed as a 2x2 matrix group. Or at least it can be double covered by a 2x2 matrix group. And that's either SL2R or SU11. And both of these are versions of the double cover of the Lorentz group. And I'll use mostly the SU11 when I refer to it. So my Lorentz group in the talk will mostly be SU11. But think Lorentz group when you see that. And similarly, the Lie algebra, I often call it as SU11. So that's my Lorentz Lie algebra of 2+1 dimensions. And the generators, there are 3 of them, have this algebra which looks like the rotation algebra. But it's quite important physically to remember that two of these guys are boosts, okay? And one of them is a rotation. There's only one rotation around, there's two boosts. Then that was the part of the symmetry, the Lorentz symmetry. Then the whole thing extends to the full symmetry group of special relativity towards one, which is the Poincaré group. That's the semidirect product. It has translations in there. And most of this is standard. So you have a semidirect product structure of Lorentz and translations. The Lie algebra reflects that. So the translations commute, but get acted on by the Lorentz transformations. But what's special in 2 plus 1 is that you have an inner product on the Lie algebra, which is non-standard, and which pairs translations and boost rotations. Okay, so that wouldn't work because you would have 6 versus 4 in 3 plus 1 dimensions. But here you have 3-dimensional Lorentz group and 3 translations. So this inner product, crucial in the story that follows. So that's a quick review of the symmetry of special relativity 2 plus 1. Next, the phase space. I said I want to emphasize the relation between the two of a particle. So the phase space of a particle, there's many ways to think about that. And I think the nicest way is to think of phase spaces of anything as a set of the manifold of all solutions of the dynamical system. That looks very redundant, but it preserves all symmetries, unlike any slicing that you might otherwise choose. So the space of all solutions of a free particle is the space of all world lines. And phase space is therefore the parameterization of all world lines. And you can parameterize a world line by giving a direction, but the length of that direction doesn't matter. So you can fix that to a constant, call it m. And you can then parameterize where the world line is by moving it in a direction that's orthogonal to the direction. So if you pick a general x, that wouldn't be orthogonal, but the vector k that's made up here, well, this part is definitely orthogonal. X wedge p is orthogonal to p. So that's a nice way of characterizing where this world line is. And then you can stick on a piece s in the direction of the world line, which is up to you. You know, you can fix it. And physically, of course, the two things that you have now been able to fix are precisely the mass and the spin of the particle. Okay? So the space of all lines in 3 dimensions, the 4-dimensional manifold, is the phase space of a particle of fixed mass and fixed spin, given by this parameterization. And that's quite a useful way to think about this. Now, phase space means I'll have to give you a phase space structure, the Poisson brackets on this. And I'll do this in a kind of backwards way, forwards in the sense of mathematics, but backwards perhaps physically. Physically, you might think, well, if I want to specify Poisson brackets, I should give you an action and then derive brackets from that. I won't do it that way. I'll give you the answer and then show you how it comes from an action. The physical viewpoint of a natural phase space, so the mathematical viewpoint of a natural phase space associated to a group is called the coadjoint orbit. There you take the Lie algebra, more precisely its dual, which is a vector space, and you act on it by the symmetry group. And the orbit swept out under this would be a symplectic manifold with a natural symplectic structure. Now, let me do that and then connect it to the perhaps more familiar physical picture of a point particle action. If I start off with a point on my Lie algebra, which, because of this inner product, can equally be thought of as a point in my dual Lie algebra. Okay? It's the fact that the coefficient of the rotation is the mass is really the statement that the mass is the coefficient of the dual of the time translation, which is more natural. And the fact that the coefficient of the spin is p0 is the statement that that's really the dual of the rotations. So if I take such an element, the Lie algebra, and I now conjugate with one of these elements, which is in the 6-dimensional group, I sweep out an orbit. Okay, I sweep out an orbit, and the mathematical theory of orbits tells you that there's a natural Poisson structure on this orbit, which I've written down here. And you recognize that the brackets are precisely the Poisson version of the Lie brackets that define the Lie algebra of the groups you started with. And that is a standard fact of coadjoint orbits, that the brackets you get are precisely the Lie brackets you started off with. Now, what's that got to do with the more familiar picture where a point particle is parameterized by its position and conjugate momentum? So you have this relativistic action and impose a constraint where the mass is constant. Well, this action, I'm now adding to this an action for the spin, which is perhaps not so familiar. So a massive particle with spin has this action. That's a good action for a massive particle with spin, where V is the boost that takes you to the momentum P.
It takes what to the momentum
takes the rest particle, so the particle sitting on the mass shell at rest. If you boost it to p, you need a boost, which is arbitrary. The rotation around the time direction is arbitrary, but in the spin action, it does enter. Okay, so this is a relativistic action for a particle with spin. And this action has a nice interpretation mathematically in terms of the language I've set up here. You can write it like this. So if you write the translation and Lorentz transformation to one group element, you write down this Lie algebra element that summarizes the mass and spin. This familiar action, it can be written as the integral over this simple expression. And from it, you can then derive these brackets quite easily. So think of these as brackets derived from the relativistic particle action. But also remember that these are brackets on the dual of the Lie algebra. And that's the phase space naturally lives in the dual of the Lie algebra. That's the thing that will get deformed in a minute. Okay. So that picture is also useful for now explaining how you can start doing gravity in 2+1 dimensions. And this is a lightning summary of an observation that goes back to Achukaru Townsend and then exploited by Witten, that you can combine the two things that characterize geometry, namely the dry button and the spin connection, into one bigger connection called the Cartan connection. And you can do in any dimension. So you have a connection that summarizes your dry button and your spin, your spin connection. And the challenge is to write down an action with that connection. And in four dimensions, you can't write down an action with that connection that gives you the Einstein-Hilbert action. But in three dimensions, you can, namely the Chern-Simons action. So I've written that down here. If you plug in this expression for the for this connection A into the expression for the action, you recover the Einstein-Hilbert action. And the curvature of this connection combines both the Riemann curvature of the spin connection and the torsion. Okay, so it combines these two things, and they come up as one connection, which is the Poincaré connection. Okay. Now, in this picture, you introduce particles in the way that a field theorist would, by minimal coupling. I told you before that without this A, this is the action for a particle, relativistic free particles. And I'm going to couple it to the connection by just replacing the time derivative along the world line with a derivative plus A. So it's kind of this kind of field theorist view of how you couple particles to fields. You do minimal coupling. And if you do that, you get an equation of motion now that relates the field strength to the particle state of motion. So the particle state of motion, remember, was obtained by conjugating the standard element that combines mass and spin. And so the left-hand side here is nothing but the momentum and angular momentum of the particle. This now acts as a source for curvature. And the curvature is Riemann curvature combined with the torsion. So both of them have come in.
Sure. The threes are the same as the zeros, is that right?
I'm sorry. Yes, you're quite right. I thought I tidied it up. But the threes are the zeros. Thank you very much. Yes. Yes, I haven't quite tidied it up. Yes. An important point is that at this moment, because the coupling in this action to the action that has a gravitational constant outside will mean that in the equation of motion, the G appears, and I've shown how it appears. It comes in by now rescaling the mass of the particle with G, which is the inverse Planck mass. So mu is now a dimensionless constant, which which characterizes the mass in multiples of the Planck mass. Okay? That's what this mu is, and that's what enters the equation. At this point, G has become absorbed, and mu is dimensionless, or equally, it's the mass expressed in multiples of the Planck mass.
Why doesn't the spin get rescaled?
Quite right. I should have an S tilde here. It also gets rescaled. But it doesn't therefore become unit less. I'm not going to talk about the spin very much more, but it's true that it does get rescaled.
And all those J3, P3 at the bottom should be J0.
Yes. 3 maps to 0. So space is 1, 2.
So 3 equals 0.
3 equals 0, right. Now, the equation of motion that we get is of a particular simple kind. So the curvature of this Cartan connection is zero everywhere, except where there's matter, in this case a point particle, and at that point you insert a singularity. And that means that the connection that you get from this equation is completely characterized, because it's flat, by its holonomies. And the holonomy around a puncture where you've inserted the particle is obtained by simply exponentiating the Lie algebra element that characterizes the singularity of the curvature. So that's what I've written down as the holonomy here, where again 3 is 0. And this holonomy captures the equation, the state of motion, in the same way in which the Lie algebra element captures the state of motion. The Lie algebra element had the information about p and k, which characterizes the world line, and this has got information exponentiated into the group. Okay. Now, what am I heading towards? Now, I'm heading towards a description of classical phase space in gravity and how it gets quantized. So that's it's a big story, so the complicated story to write on the complete phase space and its brackets. But the fact that makes it simple is that everything is encoded in holonomies, at least in this Jones-Simons formulation. So you can consider now arbitrary surfaces with particles and handles, and all you need to write down is holonomies for every non-contractible path. Then you impose that the total holonomy is 1, and you divide by conjugation. And that's the phase space of the theory. And I'm not going to talk about the structure of this, but I will pick out now the contribution to the phase space of one particle and explain briefly how that gets equipped with a Poisson structure and how that Poisson structure gets quantized. And that will then hopefully explain to you why the quantum group that I want to consider is the one.
C are complex numbers.
Where's C?
Conjugacy classes.
Yes. So it's on the down here.
Yes.
So it's these elements. So at this point, we have to distinguish two things which look like they're the same. And in the relativistic particle case, they were quite distinct. There was on the one end, there was phase space, which lived in the dual of the Lie algebra. So that was a subset, submanifold of G star. And there was the Poincaré group, which is a nonlinear thing. It's a group. And those couldn't be confused. In this case, two things suddenly begin to merge, because now we have an holonomy, which is again group valued, and we should think of it as phase space. So the two objects which were distinct now are easily confused, but they remain distinct operators in this game. And you can tell the difference in this case by Poisson structures that they get. So I'm giving this in a deductive way, and I'm giving you these Poisson structures. What was done in the literature is that people described the Poisson geometry of the space of flat connections in terms of a trick involving R matrices. That's Fock and Rossley's description. And then realize that means that what's entering here is the theory of Poisson Lie groups. So the group that's both the phase space and the symmetry is equipped with the Poisson structure. And two of them are relevant. In one version, P3, the translation part is x, and v is my Booth translation part, gets a bracket where the x's do not commute with each other anymore. So translations as Poisson brackets have a non-zero commutator. But everything else is trivial. So this is one version of the group that's relevant to us. And then there's a dual story of this, the dual Poisson Lie group, which as a group is just a direct product of SU11 and R3. And this is the one that is important in describing the phase space contribution. So the phase space is an holonomy, has a Poisson structure. And when I say that the Poisson structure is the one that's coming from the dual Poisson Lie structure of the Poincaré group, then this is what it means in practice. You have a translation part in this group element, which is now the angular momentum, and that has the commutators of the Poisson brackets of the angular momentum. You have a group element, and that group element now gets interpreted as the exponentiated momentum. Okay? So the momentum that used to be a linear object has now become part of an holonomy, and as such, it has to be group valued. But the bracket between that exponentiated p and the j is what it was. So the Poisson bracket seems unchanged, But it's important that the p's are not functions on R3 anymore. They're not coordinates on a linear space. They're coordinates on a curved space, namely the group SU11. Okay? So what we've used here is that SU11 has a Lie algebra which is three-dimensional and therefore can be identified with momentum space, and then we can exponentiate it. And that's exactly what gravity does to momentum in 2 plus 1. It exponentiates it into a group.
And yeah, can you really explain why the group gets functions?
Correct. I was coming on to that. This bracket will be important to us. I mean, this in this language would be the seed of space-time non-commutativity. So there's a Poisson bracket between positions and time, which is non-trivial. And this will follow us through the story. But what at this level, why this bracket arises is the observation that I've got this big phase space that I call P tilde, which is just a copy of two copies of the group for every handle and one conjugacy class for every puncture. And on this space, the group, the Poincaré group, still acts by conjugation, which I want to divide out. Now, that action on the conjugacy class is just conjugation of, that's not coming up in the next manifold. This action is conjugation of an element which I've cooked up for my momentum and my angular momentum by multiplying u and j together, but using the group structure of P3. Okay, so I've got a group valued. This is my parameterization of the holonomy in terms of these elements u and j. And the group P3, it acts on this by conjugation. Okay, I can obtain all of these elements by conjugating a starting one. I can also conjugate further. And this conjugation action, which is like the symmetry acting on the space, is only a symmetry if I take into account this bracket. Okay, so the symmetry is a symmetry in the sense of preserving Poisson structures, but the symmetry group itself has a Poisson bracket, which is non-trivial. And it's only if I take that into account do I get a Poisson action by conjugation. Okay, so the x's are the things that translate all my particles. So if I conjugate everything by x, I translate the particles around. But for that to be a Poisson action on the true phase space, I need the brackets between the x's to be non-trivial.
Okay. I have a more basic question. I got lost about P3. What
yes.
P3?
P3 is still, of course, P0.
Yeah, I know, but the P3, you're always talking about the group.
Okay, sorry. P3 yeah. Here is, oh my God, yes. Oh my God. P3 is my Poincaré group notation.
Yes,
and it's a generator, but I forgot, didn't get around to change it. So my Vx is
the,
so what I've done, I've written down your favorite holonomy here. A particle of mass m rescaled to mu and spin s has now been boosted by rotation boost v and has been translated by x. And I obtain a group element in P3 and I parameterize it in this way, u, and then the adjoint action of u and j. The reason why this parameterization arises is technical. But this is the right parameterization of this holonomy in terms of the physical momentum and angular momentum of the particle. And if I multiply this out, I can give a formula now for the momentum and the angular momentum in terms of the boost and translation and the mass and the spin. And the first thing you find is that what we already knew, that the group-valued momentum is the exponential of the linear momentum. And in addition, you find that the angular momentum is given in terms of x and u in quite a complicated way. So this formula at first looks complicated, but it's a nonlinear version of the vector product of x and p, and then the spin component in the p direction. Okay, so this is now the formula for momentum, angular momentum of a particle that in the end of momentum tensor, it just had p and it just had mass and spin. And that translates into phase space, in this case, as a group value momentum and an angular momentum that's given in terms of position and momentum by this formula. Okay, we're coming up to my first lesson. So I'm going to summarize what I've said in simpler terms. There's one viewpoint of this story which is simpler and doesn't quite use the machinery of Poisson Lee stories and so forth, which I want to briefly bring up as well, which is that you can reinterpret what we have just done as follows. Remember, I've told you that the momenta are group valued. The positions have a non-trivial bracket, which is not the bracket of Lorentz transformations, confusingly. And the angular momenta, the j's, are also have the bracket of the angular momentum still. That hasn't changed. Now, there's a simple geometric interpretation for that by saying, well, momentum space is a group manifold, SU11. Positions should act on that by some sort of translation, and Lorentz transformation is some sort of rotation. Well, if you have a group manifold, you can still conjugate the group element, and that is your rotation. So the j's act on the momentum space by conjugating the group manifold. And the positions, which should be translations of momentum space, act by infinitesimal left multiplication. So you have a group manifold, you can multiply from the left by a group element. So from the point of view of momentum space, the result can be summarized by saying, well, look, momentum space has become curved. That means that translations which act on momentum space can no longer commute. And it also means that angular momentum can still act by conjugation and won't need to change. So that leads leads to my first summary. And so the lesson one is that in gravity momentum space, in 2 plus 1 gravity, momentum space gets curved and acquires a curvature radius which is inverse g. Remember, g is an inverse mass, so inverse g is a mass scale. That fixes the curvature of the momentum radius. The position coordinates don't Poisson commute, but they act on this momentum space by a left rotation, and that means that they can't Poisson commute because these left multiplications are now a non-commutative group. And so their failure to commute is precisely given by g again. Okay, so this, the gravitational constant comes in. And the angular momentum algebra is unchanged. Jj is still epsilon j. But the relation between j, p, and x has become deformed. I gave you this formula, which looks a bit crazy, but it's a deformed version of the usual relationship between position momentum and angular momentum. Okay, so so that's lesson one.
Sure.
Yeah, I'll let you. So I've used the word anti-de Sitter for the first time here, but it's just observation that this group manifold SU11 is actually anti-de Sitter space in first one dimension. So you can realize this also as a bunch of a vector in four dimensions with this constraint. That's equivalent to giving the group SU11 or SL2R. So that's, you know, a big surprise or coincidence that the symmetry group itself is one of the model space times of the theory. But, you know, it's important that it comes up as momentum space, not as physical space, because physical space is completely flat. We haven't done anything about that. Okay, so I did take the promised half hour to get to lesson one, and now lessons will get quicker, because I now assume that we have understood, for example, how to get from a Lie algebra to a classical phase space. And we now expect that when you put the phase space into quantum theory, you'll have to exponentiate it. And that that means that certain physical quantities get group valued. So particularly the momentum gets group valued. And so I'm going to go through the same story again, but in no detail, but tell you what happens when you introduce a cosmological constant. Now, the cosmological constant fits in very naturally into this Chern-Simons formulation, because all you do is you change your gauge group. So I've talked about this corner up here, the Poincaré group in three dimensions. And when you include the cosmological constant, you just change that group, either to SO3,1 or to SO2,2, depending on whether you want a positive or negative cosmological constant. So I'm going to concentrate on the Minkowskian signature situation. A similar story holds for the Euclidean one. Let's write down the Lie algebra, which must of these groups, which clearly now depends on the cosmological constant. But it turns out you can write it down much more nicely if you change from the cosmological constant into one that's called lambda here, which is plus cosmological constant for the Euclidean, but minus in the Minkowski setting. If you do that, the Lie algebra in the Cartan decomposition is this in all cases. Okay, so this is the Lie algebra that we need to consider. The P's are still translations, and they no longer commute. This way of splitting the algebra still has this invariant pairing. This algebra still has this invariant pairing. But the splitting makes it doesn't allow you to talk about momenta separately from angular momenta. So I'm going to look at another decomposition, which is written down there, where you introduce a kind of shifted momentum, where you add an angular momentum piece, which is determined by vector n, which has to square to minus lambda. And if you do that, you find that the shifted momenta now just form a closed algebra. And what I've done here is called the Iwasawa decomposition of this Lie group. So this is Cartan, where you don't have sub-Lie algebras, but in Iwasawa you split into the J and the P algebra, now called P tilde. They're both sub-algebras, but the commutator between them is quite complicated. We won't need it here. I haven't written it down. The commutator between J and P tilde is it's two terms, three terms. But each of them just form a sub-algebra.
So if you're in Euclidean signature,
then this doesn't work. So if lambda is positive, and n is n squared has no solution, so then I can't do this split. In that case I don't. That's actually the case I'm least interested in. It's this case here. In that case, I can't do that. But in that case, the Lie algebra is already a product of two Lie subgroups, SU2 times SU2. So this is really the case that's where this is most relevant, where you split the J and P algebra into two copies, well, into two Lie subalgebras, one of which is still the Lorentz algebra. The other one is... this will come back later. It doesn't have a standard name, something called the Borel algebra. If you think about fixing n, for example, in the time direction, and say n is a unit vector in the time direction in the case where that's possible, then this says that everything commutes in the spatial direction because the n components are zero there, but that the commutator of the time translation with the spatial direction gives you the spatial generator back. That's what this would be saying if you picked one particular n.
P-tilde doesn't contain all the information from the group. I realize it's a combination of all the generators, but I can take a different linear combination.
It's a perfectly good way of writing down the basis of the Lie algebra.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a basis. Yeah. I've just switched from P to P-tilde. The J is still there. And the
that's why I say you still have J.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
so the J doesn't change. I've just gone from P to P.
That's fine. I thought you were saying you could eliminate the J part.
Okay. So now we know that if I write down the classical particle moving in with this symmetry group, then these brackets will come back as the Poisson brackets of this particle. Okay. So we've done that. I can just take that piece of work from earlier. And therefore, I know that momenta will no longer Poisson commute, and their failure to commute is given, of course, by the cosmological constant. So what's happened now is that space has become curved, and therefore the position space has a curvature, and momenta don't, therefore, Poisson commute. They fail to commute by the inverse of this. That's the mirror version of lesson one. Remember lesson one? Where I said the same thing about momentum space. I said that's become curved with a radius 1 over g, and therefore the positions don't commute, and their failure to commute is given by g. Okay? So that's a precise mirror image of this statement, with g playing the role of inverse LC. Okay. So far I haven't, I've shown you how two constants enter. The classical ones, the length scale, the cosmological, and the gravitational constant. And now we have to throw in h bar. And h bar enters in the quantization, of course. And I'm going to start with the free point particle again and ask ourselves how would we quantize that. Here are our brackets. And so by quantizing, I mean writing down an algebra of quantum observables. And the usual way to do that in this case is to say I'm going to take the universal enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra given by these brackets. So they contain all the j's and all the p's and all the powers of the j's and the p's with the relation that the commutator is given by the bracket. Okay. Now, so that's a simple answer. The universal enveloping algebra is the quantum algebra, and then you look for irreducible representations of that as your Hilbert space, and that would give you precisely the usual representations of a massive and spinning particle in any dimension. Now, I want to revisit this universal enveloping algebra and do something with it, so that I want to convince you that it's possible and even better to think of it as the ring of coordinates on momentum space. At this level, this might be a trivial statement. Coordinates on momentum space would be three of them. They commute, and they would get acted on by conjugation in J in exactly this way. So this is not, at this level, a deep statement. But I want to go through the steps that are involved, because they are the steps that we need to generalize. So this is, I claim, a better way to think about the Poincaré group. And it starts as follows. Think about space-time translations. Finite translations. Okay, that's a translational part of the Poincaré group. And it's a group, it's R3, it's not very exciting. And now I like to make life complicated for myself and think of this group, and I want to turn it into an algebra. So I want to think of the group algebra of such a thing. A great way to do that is to think of all the functions on the group and define the convolution product on them. That captures exactly the group structure that we started off with. The delta functions under convolutions on this function, on this space, will give you back the rule how you add translations. This works for any group. So if you look at functions on the group and you look at the delta functions on a convolution, they give you the group law back. Now, since when R3, I can Fourier transform and delta functions turn to plane waves and convolution turns to pointwise multiplication. So I can also think of the algebra of translations as being functions on momentum space, R3 star, with pointwise multiplication. That's now my group law in this. I just multiply pointwise, and that gives me back the rule for adding finite translations by the multiplication rule for exponentials. So that's what I claim is a good way to think about momenta, and hopefully that motivates a little bit where it's coming from. Momenta are functions on coordinate space, and the multiplication is pointwise as functions. Okay. Now, why is this useful? Well, first of all, let me explain how, from this point of view, you would now throw in the rotations or the Lorentz transformations, because we now want to say combine this ring of functions with the Lorentz transformations. And so this formula looks complicated at first, but it's key for the rest of the talk. So let's see what I'm saying here. I'm writing down the similar rate product rule for combining rotations and translations in this fancy language where the p's are now coordinate functions. So what I do is I have a Lorentz rotation here and here. I multiply them. And I've got coordinate functions here and here, f1 and f2. They're functions on momentum space. And I multiply pointwise, but I first boost the second argument by this rotation. This just does is just what you get from Fourier transforming your Poincaré group into this language where momenta are functions on R3 star. And the infinitesimal version of this is where you go from the group to the universal enveloping algebra. So that's the beast that I told you get out of quantizing this particle. Okay. So this is my favorite viewpoint now, this or the finite version here, where momentum space has become the carrier for function space on which Lorentz transformations act. Now, one reason why this is useful is that I can now talk about combining momenta in a fancy way. And here it may look complicated, but that's the way it can be generalized. So combining two particles means you have to tell you how to add momenta. And in Hopf algebra language, that means you have to give a co-product. That tells you how to take tensor products. So tensor products need an action of two copies of the algebra. And the co-product tells you how to divide the element between the two copies. Now, if my algebra is functions on a manifold, then this space here on the right-hand side has a nice geometric interpretation as functions on the manifold times itself. So the tensor product of functions on one manifold with functions on the same manifold is modulo technical questions that require me to specify exactly what functions I'm considering, the same as functions on the Cartesian product. And that means that if M happens to be a group, I can define a coproduct by saying I want on the right-hand side to have a function of two arguments of G, G. Well, if I only have a function of one argument to start with, I can just take these two elements together and multiply them. And that means I have a function of two arguments given in terms of the function of one argument. Okay, so this is a great co-product, a map of this type. And if I apply that to my momentum space here, it just tells me that if I have the momentum of P and Q, so these are two vectors in my momentum space, well, it's just the eighth component of the sum, because I'm supposed to add this together. So I just add momenta. So this is a fairly trivial addition rule, and written in this language, it just gives you this rule for adding momenta. So this is addition of momenta explained in this fancy language. And the language is useful because it generalizes to the situation you want to consider. Because we can now look at the same game for our Poisson algebra that came with every puncture. And the Poisson brackets were exactly the same, but the big difference was that this time the P were functions not on R3, but they were functions on the group SU11. Okay? But in that case, what we have just learned is that what you get when you quantize this is the product of the functions on the manifold where these guys take their values with the Lorentz group, which is generated by the J's. And that same story applies here. So without further ado, we can say that the quantum algebra of observables is the Sembrac product of the angular momentum algebra with functions on a curved manifold, which we interpret as coordinate functions for momenta. Now, that thing has got a name. It's called the double or quantum double of the universal enveloping algebra. And that's the first non-trivial Hopf algebra that's come up in this game. This is a Hopf algebra that's both non-commutative and non-co-commutative, in the sense that this co-product that I explained, where you add, so you get from a coordinate on a single copy of the space to coordinates on two copies by just multiplying the two copies together, that now is a non-trivial rule because this group is non-abelian. And this rule just tells you that in order to do momentum addition, what you should do is you take the group value momentum of one and the group value momentum of the other and multiply them together. So momentum addition now depends on the non-abelian group structure. You just exponentiate the guys and you multiply in this non-abelian group. And as soon as you have momentum space equipped with the group structure, you can do that. That's all we needed from the previous transparency. So that gives us lesson three in the quantum theory. We have the usual quantization of angular momentum, so that's completely standard. But in this Hopf algebra language, the statement that momentum space was curved becomes translated into the statement that momentas have a non-co-commutative addition. That's the fancy way. So the co-multiplication is non-abelian. And I've expanded here what happens when you multiply group elements and expand out the exponent. The first one is just the usual story of adding momenta, but then you get non-abelian parts. So this is anti-symmetric, and the coefficient of it is g, as it has to be for dimensional reasons. This is p times p, g is an inverse mass, so that makes sure the whole thing remains well-defined. And equally, the statement, the Poisson brackets, in this case, there was a g at the Poisson bracket for the positions. That becomes h bar times g, so that it's precisely the Planck length that controls the lack of commutativity of momenta, which now act on the momentum space by infinitesimal left action still, but now it's quantum operators. So the quantum lesson is that we have the constants h bar, g, and lp entering in this way. So, of course, you can guess what's going to happen next. I'm now going to throw in the cosmological constant and then come to a table of how all the relations are affected by the various constants. And this is now, so it's a big step that I won't go through. In fact, some of these things, in my view, are not technically completely sorted out. But there is at least a candidate for the analog of this quantum double that we discussed. And the cosmological constant is on the left. And we have discussed this case in some detail now. And the claim is that in the other cases, you get also quantum doubles of certain quantum groups, which depend on the deformation parameter, which I've given up there. That contains all the guys we've come across, h bar and g, and the cosmological constant. And the only way in which you could make a dimensionless quantity, and it's the exponential of the Planck to the cosmological length scale. So I'm not going to discuss these guys in detail, but I'm now giving you the next transparency, the result that you get from doing the analog of this calculation. So I'm going to look at all the co-commutators, all the commutators, and I'll write down the constants that control the lack of commutativity or co-commutativity. And this is what I got. This is and I hope I got it right. And so there's commutators for angular momentum controlled by h bar. For momentum, it's h bar over the cosmological length scale. So momentum generate translations on this space, which is now globally curved because of cosmological constant, and the lack of commutation is controlled by the cosmological constant or the cosmological radius. The position commutativity is controlled by G, because they act on this curved momentum space whose curvature was controlled by inverse G. And the co-commutators, they reflect, if you like, the curvature of the corresponding spaces. So momentum space had curvature G, position space had a curvature related to 1 over the cosmological length scale, and angular momentum gets curved when both of these guys are present in this way. So there's obviously various relations you can spot now between these columns, but that's the kind of promised summary of how the various constants that I gave you at the beginning and enter non-commutative structures in 2+1 dimensions. So there's one more lesson to go, and that lesson contains the relation with doubly special relativity. So that was my lightning summary of commutativity and non-commutativity in 2+1 dimensional quantum gravity. And I wanted to compare and contrast that with what people call doubly special relativity or Kappa Poincaré. And I've set things up in such a way that this should be quite an easy step now, because I've hopefully explained why a good way to think about Poincaré symmetry is to think about Lorentz symmetry times functions on momentum space. And what we saw gravity do is to curve momentum space from flat space into anti-de Sitter space. And what you do in Kappa Poincaré is just the opposite. You curve it into de Sitter space. That's the usual construction anyway. So let's see how that works, because de Sitter space, as you may know, does not have a group structure, not obviously anyway, in any dimension. So we use the group structure of anti-de Sitter space to get our co-product. So if Kappa Poincaré is based on de Sitter, how does it work? First of all, the algebra structure, so here's the Sitter space, that's three-dimensional space, and it needs a mass scale. So just in order to define this constraint, if my pi's are meant to be momenta, I need something of the scale of mass. Otherwise, this equation has dimensions, wrong dimensions. So I have to introduce a scale here, that's kappa. So kappa is a mass scale, which is what gives this guy its name. Now, I again have the Lorentz group acts on this space as an isometric group on the Sitter space. And so I can define this analog of my fancy version of the Poincaré group, where you have two copies of the we have the group being multiplied in the usual way, but you have a pointless multiplication of functions with a twist. So this is the 7-8 product nature coming in. And so we easily get an algebra. So the algebra structure just depends on having a space here, the Sitter space, on which the Lorentz group acts. No difficulties there. But now, how do I get a co-multiplication? For that, I used the product structure, the group structure of my anti-de Sitter space. To do this here, I need to do something cleverer. And this is based on this Iwasawa decomposition I told you about at the Lie algebra level. And the decomposition is to take an element in SL2C and to write it at the group level as a product of two elements that correspond to my Lorentz group and this generator's P tilde that we discussed earlier. Okay. And so it's a mathematical fact that if you take SL2C, you can factorize it into a piece in SU11 and a piece in AN, where AN is the group of all matrices of the form, with a zero down here, a positive entry here and its inverse here, and then a complex number up there. So that's a matrix group, which is abelian in this part, but has a similar product structure itself, and I've called it AN. Okay? So the miracle is, or the factorization that follows from the Ivasava, is that SO to C can be split in this way in two directions. And this is not possible globally, but it's not possible near the identity. Okay. Now, if you can factor in two ways, that means you can think of the U on this side as being obtained from the V and the R on that side, because given R and V, the U is determined, and the other way around. And you can check that this map gives you actions, namely that the U there is obtained by a left action of R and V. So the group AN2 now acts on this other group by this factorization formula. And the S on this side is obtained by a right action of V on R. Okay? So just the fact you factorize gives you instantly actions of the two factors on each other. And that's going to be crucial. The other thing that's crucial is that the sitter space can be parameterized almost totally by this AN group. So I've given this as a map. If you take the sitter space as a subspace of Hermitian 2 by 2 matrices, which is a great way to think about Minkowski space, then this map can be written unexplicitly. So it takes any AN element and maps it in here. And you can check that it covers all of, half of the sitter space, not all of it, but it covers most of it. So, okay. And that factorization is then used to define the full Kapp-Poincaré group, where you need to have a way of parameterizing the sitter space nine times of these AN matrices. So the group structure that comes into the co-product, defined down here, uses the fact that the sitter space is almost a group, not quite, but half of it is covered by a group manifold. And the factorization also enters the full multiplication rule, in which it can now be written in this way. And if you split up this multiplication in terms of the parameterization I gave earlier, you find that momentum addition is non-co-commutative. But actually in a quite a different way from what I showed you about the Kapp-Poincaré, the quantum gravity group, the Lorentz double. So this is structurally a similar beast, but in detail it is quite different. And in particular, they're certainly not isomorphic as Hopf algebras. They're very different Hopf algebras, these two. So Kapp-Poincaré does not arise as a limit of octopus one gravity. It's a different Hopf algebra, but I'd like to explain how they're related, or at least speculate on how they're related. And that's the final point I want to make, which is as follows. So this uses a trick where you, first of all, we go to the infinitesimal version, where rather than having the full group acting, we just look at infinitesimal generators of the group acting. And I've written down the Kapp-Poincaré in this language, functions now on AN, which is our parameter space for this sitter. This is momentum algebra. This is the Lorentz algebra. And then there's a map, which is a kind of non-Hermitian version of Fourier transformation, which relates algebras in duality. And it just goes from the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra to the functions on it, on the group. These are two algebras which are in duality. And I just call the map that relates it to a duality map. So the first observation is that this Kapp-Poincaré can be obtained from the universal enveloping algebra of SL2C, which is of this form, by replacing the universal enveloping algebra of AN, this dual. Okay. So there's a map that relates the sitter to Kapp-Poincaré to SL2C. But this is not something that we came across in our story about quantum gravity. So this itself does not relate Kapp-Poincaré to gravity. How it works in practice, the only way that I can see is by the following sequence of steps. So this is a bit technical, but hopefully the message is clear. Let me explain the steps first. This guy is one of the heroes in that table of algebras that you get by quantizing phase spaces in gravity. So this was a quantum double Q deformed, the Q encoded the cosmological constant. And for these guys, there's a remarkable isomorphism which only holds when Q is non-zero, not one, where you go from the functions on SU11 to the universal enveloping algebra of the dual. Well, if you apply that step to this side, you replace this by AN, and from the previous slide, that's actually universal enveloping algebra of SL2C. And then we saw that if you apply this duality map, you end up with Kapp-Poincaré. Okay? So there's a sequence of steps that takes you from one of our quantum groups to a q-deformed version of Kappa-Poincaré. And then you can take a limit where q goes to 1, where you get, on the one hand, the quantum double that I discussed in some length, and on the other hand, Kappa-Poincaré. So this is, as far as I can see, it's the only way these two guys are related mathematically. And it's a non-trivial map. It's certainly not a duality between these two, but it goes via the q non-equal to 1 range and then drops back. So there are two different limits of dual theories. So that's my lesson 5. It's about this relation between Kappa-Poincaré and quantum gravity in 2+1. In 2+1 gravity, momentum space is either a sphere, when you put Euclidean situation, which I didn't talk about, or it's anti-de Sitter space, so negative curves. And the position algebra is always given by this essentially angular momentum algebra form. In the Kappa-Poincaré, the story is quite different. Momentum space is Lorentzian, but positively curved. It's de Sitter space, not anti-de Sitter. And the position algebra has a different structure. This is the commutator that I sketched when I talked about the AN group. So there's a different level of non-commutativity. And the relationship between the two is quite complicated. You have to go to a deformed picture, and then both of them arise as limits of one kind of master Hopf algebra that you have to dualize. So it's quite a complicated map between the two. But that's the only relation that I can see between these two Hopf algebras.
Where is physically
Well, and this limit, that's right, so this, exactly, so this limit would be thought of, remember Q combined all the quantities, and this was a group that appeared when lambda is non-zero, and this was the one that appeared when lambda is zero. So this limit is the standard limit of taking the cosmological constant to zero. That's how you get from there to there. In this case, I don't have a physical picture. I don't know what this means. And so this is some q-deformed Kappa-Poincaré, which itself is dual to this. So it's a kind of Fourier transform.
But it should be expressible. I mean, any limit should be expressible in terms of you have a parameter that you send to zero. Why keeping constant some other physical quantity? Right. And as soon as you say what you keep constant in the limit, then you specify what your limit is. So there should be a way.
Well, this limit is
I mean, there's no way to reach q goes to 1. Either
sure.
H bar to
sure.
0, MC to 0, or
yeah.
P to infinity.
But in, I agree.
The limits are very, very different. And then you can, in each case, keep momentum fixed, position fixed.
But of course, in Q, once you've got Q, you don't know what any of the separate things are. And Q is just one real number. But when you take a limit,
it doesn't make sense unless you specify
yeah,
what you mean.
That's true. I mean, you take a limit in a definite way, and the only, well, so what I'm saying here is that you have limits that you can take that get you to the quantum double, which arises in 2+1 gravity, and Kappa-Poincaré. And there's no direct way of getting from one to the other. I think that's the point I'm making. What this limit is precisely is q going to 1 and then choosing your, when q goes to 1, you need to introduce a dimensionful parameter in order to define the resulting theory.
Here q going to 1 means cosmological constant.
Yes, that's right.
So here q goes to 1 means what? G Newton goes to 0?
No, I think it also means cosmological constant goes to zero because you need a mass scale to arise at the end. Otherwise, it's
why this mass scale is, could be the inverse cosmological constant of mass. I don't know. It's just
I'll just wrap up because people, you know, I've overrun and there's questions. I mean, that was my last lesson. I promised 5 lessons for, you know, the 5 most intelligent communities in the world and. Final thing is just to advertise a workshop on these matters and also related much more physical, phenomenological matters, which will take place in Edinburgh next year. If any of you are interested in that, please let me know. No, because I'm sure I'm not aware of all the people working in the field. So that was just an advert at the end. Thank you very much.
So this is a
relabeling of generators. So this is just the bijection that relabels your generators and then writes the algebra in a different way. Okay. Then this one is akin to a Fourier transform, and it's the step that I explained here, where you go from the AN generators in the group SL to C, we like to think of them as being the translations. Those are my P tildes, okay? And I've replaced them now by functions on the AN group,
in Fourier transform, if these guys are thought of translations, this would really be a position space. Okay, this would be position coordinates. But actually, in order to then interpret the result as Kaplan-Carré, you don't want this to be position space, you want it to be momentum space. So there's actually a flip when you do this. And people, I don't know how to how to make that mathematically precise, but the usual interpretation from here to here involves exchanging the cosmological length constant with G. Because on the left hand side you have you have the translations in space, and here you have functions on momentum space. That's how you want to view it.
Right, so that's what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You have two scales, Planck lengths and cosmological lengths. Mm-hmm. And the duality you're describing here is that, right, so physically it's clear what it means, but at some point you could say, well, let me exchange the two. So let me treat one as being a curvature, treat the cosmological scale as being a curvature.
Okay, I'm
in the momentum space now. And then take the limit where, and I exchange the rules.
Yes.
Because in the fully equivalent regime, it's true that 2 plus 1 is weird, because in some sense, there is the duality. You can exchange NP and NC.
Well, except you can't. I mean, you can't. Now, I wish to make the statement that in 2 plus 1, gravity teaches us that physics in a universe with Planck length LP and cosmological length LC is equivalent to one where you take the inverse.
But
the inverse of both.
You exchange the two, and then you get mixed up, and you take your momentum space to be your position space.
So if I take LP divided by LC, if I send LP to H bar divided by LC, LC to H bar divided by LP, so that this ratio is unchanged.
Yeah,
then length has become a mass scale here, and vice versa. Yeah,
and you also have to exchange what you mean by your positions is now your momenta and your momenta.
Sorry, I meant one over. No, that's right. Sorry. Come again.
Yeah. Well, if at the same time you get confused, you exchange the positions with the momenta.
Yeah.
You treat momenta as positions. Then that's more or less.
More or less, but it's not actually exactly true, and it is not true that if you
so you don't get the same algebra.
No, exactly.
But that's the duality you're describing is that you exchange LP and C, and you exchange, and what was before your space, you treat it as momentum space, and then you get a completely physical, let's say, dual interpretation, which is weird.
But I know something like that is being conjectured, but I don't at the moment actually see that in precision. I mean, how precisely you could say. If you, an alien comes along and gets confused about what's length and what's mass, then they would actually describe physics in terms of this dual theory. That's the kind of statement one might like to, but I don't.
More or less.
It smells like that.
At this quantum level, you get confused. I mean, length and momenta, and in some sense, maybe for some people, somebody gets confused because it gets completely mixed up. So they have a different behavior, but they're the same property, both of them. So,
okay.
Let's close here.
Okay. Okay.